You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Colonel retired Dr. Liam Collins, Director of the Madison Policy Forum, co-founder and co-director of the Urban Warfare Institute, and co-author, along with Jason Giroux and me, of the new Modern War Institute Urban Warfare Project case study number 16, the 2008 Mumbai attacks, and the topic of today's podcast. Liam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, I'm going to do a quick intro and dive right into this new case study that we've released, number 16, and there's so many more to do. I'll put the link to the case study so everybody can go read it in the show notes, but I'm going to do this quick intro and then we dive right into it. On November 26, 2008, 10 Pakistan-based Lashkar-e-Taiba terrorists infiltrated Mumbai and launched near simultaneous attacks on five sites across the city, paralyzing a metropolis of 17.9 million people for over 60 hours. By the end of the siege, the attackers had killed 174 people and wounded more than 300. The date became known as Mumbai's 9/11 and is still referred to in India and around the world simply as 26/11. So that's the topic of our study that we just released. I wanted to have you, Liam, on the show and just kind of go over an overview of the attack. What are some of the lessons? And the first question I want to really take on is why now? Why did we decide to release this now? I have kind of my reasons, but I'm curious as well to yours. We visited, so everybody, the listeners know, we, the Modern War Institute at West Point, Liam and I, and a group of, I think it was like nine cadets, part of our contemporary battlefield assessments, visited Mumbai, India, walked every site and basically did a staff ride for the cadets and a kind of a contemporary study of this attack, walking to every site. And I mean, it was just mind blowing, but why do we just release it now?
Yeah. I mean, we released the case study because Mumbai attacks remain still one of the most important urban warfare events of the 21st century, yet really remains understudied by the military community. And as you said, there's no substitute for going there and walking the ground, right? Anytime you can do that instead of just looking at other reporting on it and trying to piece it together, you just can so much better understand it and describe what happened. So in 2019, it gave us a chance to walk the ground, talk to people. We actually talked to the owners of the Leopold Cafe. We talked to a chef that was in one of the hotels that was, escaped. So really gives us a chance firsthand to see, understand that terrain, the density, the layout, the flows of the city. Anybody that's been to Mumbai knows it's a very busy city, and trying to get my morning run in there was brutal. But India conducted a major investigation after the attack, the Pradhan Committee. Basically, India's version of the 9/11 Commission produced a detailed report that really provided some insight to it, but again, you got to go there and study it.
Yeah, I agree. So the listeners know, Liam and I travel the world together, and doesn't matter if we're in Kyiv, Ukraine, weeks after the Russians pull out, or in some very remote location, Liam's going to go out and do his run. I agree with you that it's kind of understudied. Of course, as the urban warfare kind of guru studying everything, especially megacities, that's where my research started. It was really appealing to me, but I agree with you that I think the 2008 Mumbai attacks was heavily studied by law enforcement right after the attack. There was even a U.S. congressional requirement to do a report as like, is a Mumbai possible in like New York City? And it's come up recently, even there's a couple popular podcasts where my friend Sarah, kind of a counterterrorism expert, brought it up about Fahedin attacks, basically where the terrorist comes in, doesn't necessarily blow themselves up, but they're going to kill as many people as possible. And then, with knowing that they're going to die. So it's come up kind of recently, but I agree with you, the massive, which is really heavily cited in our case study, the Pradhan Committee report done by Indian specialists. We actually met one of the authors of the report on our trip. But I also say the testimony of the Pakistan-American David Headley that we'll talk about, his detailed testimony was important for being able to kind of go through the analysis of what was already produced versus what we did, which just as a, not to complain, but as an author, since this attack happened at five different locations simultaneously, it was like writing six or seven case studies at once and then trying to put them together in time and space. So you can imagine, of course, responding to all this at the same time. But I think I agree with you. I think it's remains one of the most important urban warfare events of the 21st century, the top of the list, based on many of these variables of course, this was a national response that involved Army, Navy, basically national level CT assets, of course, local police. It involved everybody. It definitely had a military, even a, you know, from a littoral security perspective. There's so many interesting facets of this, what seems like a kind of a policing operation, but it was an attack of a nation using like every domain, even cyber domain that we'll talk about. Okay.
Hey, John, just to, again, put it in, to remind the listeners or some people that may have been too young to really remember it, given it was 2008, it was 10 people, 10 terrorists from Lashkar-e-Taiba paralyzed the city, basically held the city hostage for 60 hours. It froze. A city of 18 million people froze for 60 hours while they carried on their attack. And I think everybody that was alive remembers seeing and still, you know, can see in their head that the Taj Mahal hotel burning.
So I'll go with this. I enjoy this type of, I agree with you. And this is where if you try to do like an elevator pitch on like what happened, why was it so important? As a military analyst, I also like to remind people that these were, we'll talk about some of their training, but they were basically untrained. I mean, let's say lightly trained. These weren't like, you know, tier one special forces operators because of the kind of the plausible deniability and the impoverished radicalization, doing it for mainly financial, some religious, all these reasons. But because they had earpieces in, so for me as kind of also a social media, not only did those images you're talking about, the Taj Mahal was kind of the, you know, something as important as actual fighting was the image, and what the terrorists wanted was that global image of being able to do this to a city of this scale and bring it to its knees, basically overload it, which is very similar to what I discovered on October 7th in southern Israel when they overload all of the EMS, security, military by, you know, flooding so many different locations, blinding you with the chaos and the flows of the area. That's what I saw. So I like to remind people, not only was it only 10 terrorists, which nine of them died, one of them captured, which we'll talk about why, which was critical also to the study, is what did he say and why do we know so much about even the preparation outside of even Headley's information, is this one terrorist that was captured was provided immense amounts of intelligence on who he was, where he was from, how he was trained, how they conducted the operation that are critical. But for me, it's like these weren't that that much of a highly trained force, but they had these earpieces in which their Pakistan puppeteers basically were directing them on every step of the operation. Okay, for the overview of the city. So if anybody doesn't know, and again, I love the study cities as much as I do urban warfare. I mean, Mumbai is one of the mega cities of the world, you know, a population of over 10 million. Even in 2008, it had over 17 million, like we mentioned before, but also extreme density. I've heard people overuse that term today of like densest place on the earth or whatever. And like, go visit Mumbai, go visit like the Diwali slum like we did, where it's like a million people per square mile. I mean, it's the density is insane. But it's also a littoral, you know, city with waterfront access. It has a both a very historic buildings. It has a very distinctive flow early morning, late at night, where all the workers are coming from the residential areas, going back to our 40th Infantry Urban Warfare Planning course, the functions of a city, where most of the workers work outside of the city center, but they migrate in and migrate out, which becomes important during the attack. Even the traffic, which it was the first thing we experienced on visiting Mumbai, getting from the airport to our hotel, is just the traffic. But also even infrastructure investments as the city has grown. It's a fascinating study. There's even only three main railways that feed into the central part of the city, which for me was fascinating, just as a perspective of that transportation aspect. And when the terrorists hit one of these hubs of the railway station, the main one, why was it so important? That's a brief overview of the city. You want to add anything, Liam?
Yeah, I mean, really, Mumbai is on a long peninsula, and where the attacks happened were at the very end of the peninsula. So the last train station is one of the places, but it's at the end. There's probably a couple million people just right in that area. But anybody that would have to get to that location from anywhere else in the country would not only have to get to Mumbai, but then they would have to get through Mumbai to get there.
And this will feed right into, I agree with you, and this will feed right into the reconnaissance that was done for this attack, which was the military planning of it. It is impressive, the amount of planning that went into it, but understanding, I think it was, who was it? The four-star general that came back from the Battle of Mosul. We were at a megacities conference in like 2017, and he said if he could change all of military planning, he would add flows of the city. Well, Mumbai actually is a lesson in the reconnaissance of this city was done, and it impressively understood the flows of the city, not just the transportation we're talking about, but even the societal differences, like in the fishing slums that we'll talk about, or high rise, you know, like the Taj Mahal is this five-star iconic hotel literally on the waterway of Mumbai. That aspect of understanding the social economic, the actual structure of the city all became important in the 2008 Mumbai attack. So for the reconnaissance, there, you want to say allegedly, although the trial is over, American Pakistani David Headley had two names. We'll use David Headley. He played a central role in conducting the reconnaissance because he had his passport and other things. But the amount of reconnaissance he did, I think it was five or six visits, surveilling every site, taking photography of them, video. He stayed at the hotel, at the Taj, more than one time, videoing the intricacies of it. He took GPSs and basically waypointed not just the path from outside the city's waterways in, but also the direct landing locations, the attack locations. He would take all this back to Pakistan, to Lashkar-e-Taiba, the ones planning it, and provided that level of intelligence for not just the infiltration of the city, but immense amount of detail on the city sites, the city itself, the past, and everything. You have to give credit to the amount of intelligence, but also interesting how they use this special individual who had special access to travel to be able to provide that intelligence.
Yeah, and he really validated everything from the, you know, that kind of backward plan the operation, just like a good military organization would do, starting with, okay, what targets do you want to hit to have the biggest political impact? Validated those targets, which I think that, you know, they did that. That was part of what he did. Figure out how do you get to that target, what the movement routes, and then really what is your infiltration method. And so part of it was reconning the area and understanding how that city operates. And in there, he realized you could just go to these docks, right? Tons of fishermen go out every morning and come back. It's not really monitored. There really is no the police presence in those communities is super low. The police are more where the higher, you know, higher wealthy residents live. And so he realized, hey, you could easily infiltrate into this route, move through the city, and then hit the target with really being undetected.
Yeah. And the only thing I'll add there is also that socioeconomic perspective, because of these, and we're talking a very large amount of fishing slums along the boat, along the coast, is that they're not let's say registered citizens. So there is a hypothesis that they're less likely at the time to communicate to the police an abnormality in the environment, right? So it's almost like an autonomous area. It's not like a no-go area, like a favela in Rio de Janeiro or anything. But I think that was interesting to me, as well as in the selection that was done, as much so, which I think we have to mention that, which is the next kind of topic, is the launch from Pakistan and the infiltration, is that when they landed, it was also timed to be at the same time of a major, was it India and...
Yeah, major cricket match. So
cricket match, yeah.
Kicking it on a night when you know people are going to be inside, focused on the match, that kind of thing. Maybe, I don't know if they were watching it on their phones at that time, but...
No, yeah, TV, yeah.
TVs, I think it was TV. Yeah.
Even the Leopold, right? They were on watching,
yeah, watching the TV. Yeah, the Leopold was packed, people watching the game on the TV.
Yeah, okay. So that takes us into the infiltration, which I don't want to be, you know, we don't have a lot of time for it, but as somebody who has, you know, a land power guy, what these terrorists did to go from Pakistan, Karachi, to Mumbai is impressive. And there is detail from the captured terrorist amount of training that they got from, to include what is believed to be military personnel on naval operations, sea boarding of another vessel. So based on everything that's known, these 10 terrorists launched from Karachi after months of preparation through Lashkar-e-Taiba and what is believed to be military support, they made their way out to sea and then hijacked at sea an Indian fishing trawler that would allow them to kind of move along the coast and without being seen. They killed the entire crew except for the captain and guided their way, again, under GPS and everything, to the outskirts of Mumbai, where they then killed the captain and boarded two small inflatable boats Zodiacs that they had painted yellow in order to match the colorful fishing boats in the two locations that they would land that we visited and we saw. Like, that makes sense. All these fishing boats, they had like just very bright colors. That was an interesting, the amount of minor detail they went into in order to do the infiltration.
Right, so they're infiltrating in darkness, but yes. Rather than go black, you know, try to be surreptitious, their best camouflage is bright color, like, and blend in with everybody else, look like the locals.
Absolutely. So they land. You talked about the peninsula. If you have a map of Mumbai, they land in two different sites on basically opposite sides, which is almost like, you know, one is none, two is one, kind of redundancies in the landing sites. I think personally, they, I'm sure they traveled a certain distance together, split for the peninsula and landed in two sites.
One on the east side of the peninsula, one on the west side.
Right, in Badwar Park and Sassoon Docks. They hit the shore. And then I thought this, again, was very impressive, the amount of detail that went into what they were wearing. So they actually were seen, one of them was seen. But they were dressed in camouflage, like you said, into the flows, like Western tourists. So they had these giant backpacks, but they had Western t-shirts, ball caps. They even had all the way down to the red bracelet that is kind of a touristy item to grab, a religious red bracelet that they put on. They looked younger. Of course, in those backpacks, I call them the backpack from hell. In each backpack was, of course, an assault rifle, AK-47. There was IEDs that they had prepared. There was lots of grenades. There was a little bit of food. What else, Liam?
Yeah, I mean, that basically what they need, communication, right? They had satellite
to talk
to their handler back in Pakistan that was helping orchestrate the operation throughout.
So if you think about it, I mean, basically, you know, they hit the boats with these colorful Zodiacs. They're supposed to sink the boats, and one of the teams actually, you know, again, these are basically, in my view, just glorified privates.
Right. These are supposed to be a suicide attack. They're going to go there, conduct this attack, and be dead by the end of it. But the key is that a couple of them must have gotten cold feet, because
it's
thinking that one crew sunk their boat and flattened it like they were supposed to. The other left it because they looked like they were planning on getting away.
That's right. That's the two that leave the. I don't mind jumping around personally. I mean, I just enjoy the conversation. The two. That's my hypothesis, which I don't think I've ever seen in print. That why the two terrorists that attack the railway station and the hospital are trying to make their way back to the coast. I think they're trying to make it back to the boat.
Yeah. The fact that one was captured and they left their boat open is kind of a, you know,
yeah,
it's right. pretty compelling that they decided that they weren't going to sacrifice themselves for Allah.
And we've seen this in other styles of terrorist attacks, even suicide bombings. There's always like a fail safe, right? Where there's somebody sometimes watching that will blow it up if the person gets cold feet. So I think that's, you know, this was well planned as well by the handlers to create those. You don't have a choice. And we know, again, from intercepted, which I think is interesting, during this operation, there are intercepted communications that what the handlers were telling and what had to tell the terrorists throughout the attacks to continue to motivate them, to talk about their families and the money that their families would get when they died, for the religious reasons, was a part of that. Okay, so now you have two teams of 10 terrorists who have hit this ground. They're under backpacks. They're camouflaged like tourists. And then they split up into...
Yeah, five teams of two, of which two of them are going to regroup later. But yeah, they split up into five teams of two with,
that's right,
with one of them, their target's going to be the main train station down there, which probably, if you look... It's one of the 10 busiest rail stations in the world, depending on what list you look at. It could be up there, but millions flowing into that station every day. They're going to hit that in a hospital kind of on the northern end of town. They're going to have to take a cab to get up there. Another group hitting the Oberoi and Trident Hotel on the western side of the peninsula there. That's a two-person team going in there. A two-person team going to the Nariman House, which is a Jewish center. And then... Two-person teams are going to go and hit the Taj Mahal Hotel, but one of them hits the Leopold Cafe on the way there. So depending on how you view it, a total of five or six targets that they hit total. And the distance between these is basically in a box that's less than a mile wide and kind of 2 miles from north to south. So a pretty small area in terms of geography, but in terms of population, that you're talking well over 1 million or 2 million people just in that area.
Yeah. And so this is happening, like you said, during the cricket match. Before we got there, based on the time, it's like 9:30-ish around. I didn't think the city would be that active, right? Depending on what city you're talking about. But for Mumbai, that's still like rush hour, basically. And that's what I discovered doing the recon for us, you know, but the night before we took the cadets there in 2019, we were going to visit in the morning, me and, one of the Downing scholars went there and at like 10:30 at night and like, wait a minute. Like I thought this thing would be empty and it's just bustling just based on the workday. And that's when everybody is trying to head out of town. The cafes are bustling. The hotels are active. Maybe I'm just getting older with kids. I'm like, for some reason, my clock starts to wind down around 9 PM. And that wasn't the case on this night. I think one point you made about this splitting up into five two-man teams, two of the two-man teams jumping in cabs and then setting IEDs on timers in the cabs, which both explode after the attack, which really gets to the planning of simultaneous of this, is that you basically have the entire, if you're kind of thinking about urban policing, the entire city explodes in the same amount of time. And there's even a record of how many, it's like 2,000 911 calls or something, because you have literally all four separate sites hit, based on time, almost the exact same time across this small area, but still across the city, and two explosions of IEDs. So it's just sheer chaos that is created in a matter of minutes.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't look like they had synchronized their watches before to say, hey, let's everybody hit your target at the exact same time. Yet with two teams taking taxis and the other three teams on foot, they hit all the targets between 9:20 and 9:44. So pretty good synchronization there to hit all those targets.
Especially with a group of privates.
Right. So pretty impressive there.
Yeah. And this is where we struggled on how do you write about, like, how do you tell a story that's happening all at the same time? And while, like, if somebody just wants to there is a great book called The Siege that really talks about just the Taj Mahal. And then there's a movie called Hotel Mumbai, which actually integrates both the Oberoi Trident and it integrates multiple the sites like you have to in cinema into one, but it's a good movie. But so we really challenged even listing, okay, list the sites chronologically as based on the timing of the attack where the first shot is fired.
The Nariman House and was it 9:20, and the Oberoi Trident Hotel was at 9:20. Leopold Cafe, what this one looks like, it was just a target of opportunity is the way I interpret it. Maybe not, but I think the two teams are moving individually to the Taj Mahal Hotel, and then this team just decided to shoot up a cafe on the way there, saw what has a – it's a relatively open cafe, kind of open side, because, like, unlike the other attacks, where every other attack they go in and they stay for an extended period of time. Yeah. I guess they – not so much at the train station, but that's so open. But they went in there at 9:30, you know, basically shot up everybody, tried to go upstairs. Somebody blocked the door by throwing some furniture down to block the door. And then the two just moved out and continued on to the Taj Mahal Hotel, which they then hit as the last target at 9:44. So yeah, that looked more like a target of opportunity, but really still created chaos and killed a number of people that were there.
Yeah, I think it was, so I'm fine if we disagree. I think that I have to remember back to the David Headley investigations. I think it was one of the targets, right? It is a well-known Western cafe. And like you said in the intro, we went and sat down with the two owners, brothers, talked to them about that night. There's still bullet holes in the wall. There's still a hole where the grenade was thrown, which is, and it's really open. It's really small. When I heard kind of famous cafe, I thought it would be a lot bigger, but it's really small. So the terrorist hit it, you know, two guys pull open AK-47s, throw a grenade. And then I think that's where the first time that I thought through kind of the first responder, because you just walk through the times of all the attacks of both of all five sites at the same time. But it isn't like there wasn't a first responder there.
Yeah. By the time the first responder showed up, they were already gone.
Yeah. In that case, but like in the CST, there's a police station co-located with the CST is the main name for the train station. It's, we kind of debated on the acronym, but
CST is too hard for us to say, so we'll just call it the train station.
That's right. But they're overmatched, right? So you have, yeah, there is some history there of the development of Indian police versus what are the basically their version of the SWAT teams, and the study kind of went into all that, especially the Indian study. But it's just a fact that the police were, you know, many of them didn't, you know, had like a 301 infield bolt action rifle, had a plastic helmet, nobody with body armor. There is a lot of that, which is, again, back to that kind of policing lesson learned, but also the just being overmatched, and which is also an evolution of kind of tactics on, especially in the places like the Nariman House, which is the Chabad, the Jewish center. I've learned a lot about those in the last couple of years, which was actually a target that was put on the list later in the kind of planning for the Mumbai attacks. But the Chabad or the Nariman House and the two hotels where there were sieges planned, some of the initial first responders were basically going into that kind of hostage situation where you surround and isolate it, which was really the start of active shooter responses. That's not what you do. The first responder responds first and enters with whatever he has. And that this is kind of, I think, some of the genesis of that. Of course, in all around the world, from the Beslan theater attacks, everything is that you can't isolate and surround a site. You have to enter what you can. And that's,
but in this case, right, a lot of times those first responders did enter with their way undermatched capability. And a lot of them, you know, did the brave thing, and a lot of them got killed because they were just over outgunned and outmatched. And so I think a lot of times they did go in there first. And unlike the U.S., a lot of U.S. cities that have a SWAT team, as you said, John, they don't have any equivalent there. Guns aren't prevalent in Indian society, and therefore, right, that their police typically don't have those. They don't have the SWAT teams, despite, if you look, they did have, you know, quite a number of terrorist attacks prior to this, but this was unique in how the operation was conducted. A lot of those were more suicide IED attacks. That was what they were built to, right? React to a scene after it's already been done, as opposed to respond to an active event as it's ongoing. This was the first time they really had to respond to that. So it was, you know, really a inability to kind of think of what was possible, what the enemy might do, much like, you know, on 9/11 or in October in Israel. It's kind of the inability to kind of anticipate what would be possible.
That's right. And there is, every site has stories of heroes. I mean, you have, I mean, from the CST, a police throwing plastic chairs at the terrorist because he doesn't have a weapon, to first commander on the scene, basically being the commander for days, and is putting people in elevated positions around.
No, or chef in the Taj Mahal, one of the restaurants, that's right, you know, sneaking people into the basement kitchen to get them out of there.
Yeah, there's, every one of these has like a story of a hero. I mean, to include, which I think we should talk, let's talk through the CST, because I think that's one of the most dynamic sites. And
That's the terminal for the listeners that don't know what CST is.
The train station, sorry. So they hit the main train station and it's full of people, right? They go in, they hit the, there's a, you can see them on camera. It's a famous video. The terrorists, they look like Western terrorists, young men, baseball caps. They go into the bathroom, they take out their weapons, they motivate themselves, they come out and just start shooting people. And it's chaos.
In 20 minutes, they killed 58 and wounded hundreds more.
Yeah. Just that one site alone. I mean, you can see, because again, going to visit there, if anybody's ever seen the video of the Mumbai trains, of how packed they get, and how even on a terminal stand, I mean, there's just thousands of people waiting for that next train. And then within minutes, they're, it's really tight. I mean, like, it reminded me of Tokyo. I wasn't even brave enough to try it. So they do the attack. And then for some reason, unknown, they leave the site and they don't try to hold it. It could be because of how open the planet
Just be tough to defend, right? Easy place to kill a lot of people, but tough to really hold for an extended period of time, right?
That's right.
Like, you don't have the hotels where you have an atrium, a wide open atrium where you can just shoot down, or stairs or places to move. It's pretty open there.
Yep.
And so they're vulnerable. So it was time to pick up and move out and go to a hospital nearby where they could shoot up a lot more.
Yep. And we walked that path from the train station to the hospital, not far. And we know now that, of course, everything is blowing up. This is the age of cell phones. So there are people who are communicating, you know, kind of 911 is basically blocked, you know, like overloaded at this point. The radio communication, the police is going off. You have the main ATS, which is kind of their counterterrorism SWAT combination that they had created, at like you said, after previous attacks, to include, there was even a Delhi, I think it was the embassy or the parliament building that was attacked. Lots of lessons from there, but the main commander of this ATS force grabs
anti-terrorism squad
grabs some officers and heads to the train station, while these terrorists are heading to this hospital. And the hospital staff are hearing the gunfire, because they're also, the terrorists are shooting as they basically exfil, and they're shooting along the way. And there's some, again, the hero stories of nurses who are getting phone calls from people, did you hear? And they can hear the gunfire, and they start locking down wards in the hospital. And that kind of, I think, is a key point in, again, the responses that are happening all throughout this attack. the terrorists get into the hospital compound, they kill the two guards, and they enter the building. And then you have the ATS personnel, the Indian anti-terrorist squad police people making their way, and now they hear about the hospital. Some people, now there's a gunfight happening in the hospitals. The terrorists get up to the sixth floor. Again, like you said, the police bravely enter, and I think three of the six that entered are killed there. And then the terrorists are able to exfil and come out of the hospital or on the street, while the head commander of the ATS is in a car headed to the train station, and they basically ambush the car, which is a very iconic almost moment in this attack, because one, it's the highest ranking officer that ends up getting killed, but then the terrorists go on this, jump into a car, and then basically go on a multi, point, almost chase where they're running into police barricades. I believe they're trying to head back to their insertion point.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Okay. And then they hit a roadblock, one of the final police roadblocks that they hit. And then there's a, just this chaotic scene. And then there's an Indian police officer who gets close enough to one of them and grabs the barrel and basically takes a full point blank shot to the chest of an AK-47, dies on the spot. But that act allows another police officer to basically tackle that terrorist.
Yeah, so the other terrorist, right? And then gets all that information, all that intelligence off of them.
Yeah. And not to belittle it, but he talked a lot, let's say, because it wasn't, the reasons and everything. Okay, that's this.
They started at the train station at 9:40. They were at the hospital around 10:35, and it's about 12:20 when they're captured kind of on the coastal highway. So that's, less than 3 hours. That's all done. Leopold Cafe, like we said, that was minutes. The Oberoi Hotel went on for a couple days. But I'd say let's jump down and go to the Taj Mahal.
Okay, but yeah. Let me talk. I have to talk because I think it's important. Like you said, five teams of two, the two terrorists who hit the Leopold shoot it up within minutes. They actually walk through the cafe and go out the back door. They can't get up to the second floor. They drop an IED, go back to each one of these terrorists had an IED, and they're actually at all the sites. They drop an IED there as they move the less than two blocks, and we actually walk this as well, to the Taj, enter the Taj through the pool entrance, while two other terrorists are entering the front of the Taj on the kind of the coast side, drop an IED there, and now you have two teams almost simultaneously entering the Taj Mahal, which is an iconic, very old hotel. It actually has an old section and a new section. I took photos because the true labyrinth of this site is hard to tell people in writing or in word, and if you don't experience this. I mean, it's just this very old, high upper luxury hotel with hidden corridors for the staff. And this really plays out if you think about responses, and as we get into urban warfare, understanding buildings, understanding the layouts, at all of these sites, most of the responders, to include when they bring in the, which we haven't talked about, the main kind of counterterrorism force that was created after really the Munich attacks, the Munich Olympic attacks. Every nation basically has them, but the Black Hats is what they're called, are the Indian counterterrorism force that is sitting in Delhi without an ability to get to Mumbai, which is not a short trip. And when they show up, they don't have the layout plans, which is why I'm talking about the layout plans of understanding the layout of the Taj and what it would be like fighting through it is really hard to explain to people.
Yeah, as you said, I mean, we walked around the hotel. If you were in the new wing and trying to navigate to some room in the old wing, it'd be challenging to, it would take you some time, and that's without being under fire. It's definitely challenging. Again, to kind of put time on this, it's 9:44 when they really open fire there and drop those IEDs, 24 minutes after the first attack. And by this time, right, the 9/11, everything's you know, exploding. Police are responding everywhere. So this is just the last or the latest iteration of already, you know, overwhelmed force trying to figure out what's going on. But the police do get there. Again, it's a kind of hotel. They get there within 11 minutes. But really, despite getting there within 11 minutes, the battle there goes on for 60 hours just in one building.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, this is a, so you have two in the Oberoi and you have four in Etaj. And this is really an understanding of how, with the instruction they were being given, which was, I think, expert level of what to do, how to do the attacks, how to deploy their grenades, how to take the high ground. And in both situations, the terrorists kind of take the advantage of the terrain, take high ground. Even in the Taj Mahal, there's this kind of grand stairwell that they're shooting up, and the two teams of two link up at the grand stairwell, and they immediately take a kind of an elevated position and throwing grenades down at those first responders, which, you know, most of them have either a pistol, personal pistol if they're off duty, or a, you know, this bolt action rifle if they have anything.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, they overwhelm them throughout the entire fight for sure.
Okay, agree. And then there's basically, and you can watch it in the movie, but it's, you know, what the terrorists are doing, going room to room, trying to get people and to create fire. So that for me was a big moment when the handlers basically remind them that they're supposed to be creating fires, which does become a challenge. As you think about urban warfare, most people don't think about the fire hazards in any city, and then the smoke and everything that causes beyond what equipment you have. A lot of tactical lessons.
Yeah, it allows them to really hold that terrain longer by lighting those fires. Like you said, the challenges of fighting through smoke and fire. And the other thing, right, this is all being covered by the media, so on live broadcast. And so the handler back in Pakistan is watching this live broadcasting, telling them how to leverage the situation. And that definitely, you know, there's nothing you can do to stop the live broadcast, but that's just something to be aware of, that they can use that against you.
I mean, it was more than just a TV, right? It was social media as well, even in 2008. And I remember, and this is, again, in the book and in movies, where from within the Taj, you know, everybody's communicating out as well. And that's like communicating to reporters that are reporting it on TV. And then the handlers are like, hey, go to the chambers, which is a kind of the lounge in the Taj, because there's a group stuck there. So the terrorists get that information, then head to that room where there's a collection of people that are trying to hide, basically.
Yeah. And yeah, just kind of summarizing key points from this is, right, the attack happened the evening of the 26th. It wasn't until the 28th in the morning, right? More than, you know, 30 hours later, when the National Security Guard, right, their key counterterrorism force, finally arrived at that hotel, right? That's how slow it was to respond. Like John said, it didn't have dedicated air assets. And then they weren't able, it took them another 25 hours after that to clear the building, right, of four terrorists because of the labyrinth, the smoke, and the fire. But I mean, 25 hours to clear a building of four people.
Yeah. And this, you're just that, not knowing how many there were, like, it's a law enforcement, but also a military thing, because there were army personnel at this point on the external kind of isolation of the Taj. I mean, there's so many lessons, and I think that was important. And if we can, with the remaining time, go into our lessons. I mean, there's hundreds of lessons, and some I would argue even Mumbai, as we talked through in 2019, of what did you make the changes based on this lesson, like the fact that there weren't enough patrol boats to secure the littoral areas, and the handoff between Navy, Coast Guard, and Mumbai Naval Police, kind of Coast Police. There's some issues there, or the helicopters and all this. But let's go into the lessons that we took and that are in the study. I'll do the first one, the strategic lesson that, you know, urban warfare can be initiated by non-state actors without advance warning, and the attacks draw significant attention at the national, political, and military level. So this isn't just a local city attack. Non-state actors can deploy, and as we've seen since Mumbai, even with, you know, like the drones and things like that, attacks, coordinated attacks against cities, and it is this layered local and national level assets that is your security, it's a strategic lesson for sure.
Yeah. I mean, another thing is, you know, Pakistan and other nation states, right, use proxy groups, conduct covert wars on others. And they do this because it allows them to maintain plausible deniability. But that deniability was severely eroded when the Indians captured one of the terrorists. So as always, right, you know, you want to save people, you know, prevent them conducting more attacks. But if you can capture someone alive versus dead, it's always gives you a valuable source of information that might have longer term effects than just understanding that battle. It could have political effects as well.
Absolutely. And the I think the intercepted telecommunications was important as well. So the first operational lesson that I think that we had was that the need for security forces to possess a deep understanding of urban terrain in which they operate. And I've gotten this, you know, from combatant commands on, you have country experts, but you don't have city experts. And I think we even went to the embassy in Delhi and said, okay, who's your Mumbai expert? Like, well, we don't have one. When sometimes cities are more important than nations, the ability for security forces, and that means all of them, to have a deep understanding of urban terrain to include these flows and all of this is vital. And I think most nations of the world are lacking in that. Even though there are some tactical lessons of understanding even Mumbai, that was a challenge even for Mumbai police. That's the first operational lessons, that it's very operational for a theater of operations to understand those cities.
And we're not saying it's realistic for their national counterterrorism force to have an understanding of the Taj Mahal Hotel, for example, but knowing who has that expertise, right? Like the fire department in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Right. They know every building in that city, right? Each little fire knows their buildings. There should be somebody in Mumbai, and they should know how to talk to that person when the time comes. And that kind of ties into the second, is if you have this national force, right, you've got to be able to deploy it, or there's no point of having it, right? They weren't necessarily as well trained at the time as they may be now, but it didn't matter. If it takes them 24 hours to get somewhere, that's way too long. They needed to have dedicated air assets if you're going to have this force.
Yeah, 100%. I think that one's a huge one. I agree with you on the Rolodex of knowing who, and I've traveled the world around cities. People think that even within city administrations that they know more than they do, especially like the underground, and that's a separate conversation. So the third operational level is that for a unified and resilient command structure for security and emergency service to manage complex multi-site urban attacks. Of course, this is a lesson that most people of the world who analyzed the Mumbai attacks took from the fact that that was a big challenge, is maintaining unity of command, who's in charge of this, and then having a command center that had that capability to manage, whether it's mass casualty events or like this, a multiple site attack, it is both a local, citywide, metropolis aspect, but it was definitely a lesson from this one.
Yeah, well, and one of the tactical lessons is understanding how the attackers use the natural flows and the noise of the megacity to move undetected through dense civilian patterns to exploit the gaps, right? And it wasn't that they moved clandestinely, right? It was the opposite. They moved overtly by, right, blending in with that population. Again, you can't mitigate the gaps. It's not, right, they have limited resources. You just can't, you know, maintain, you know, patrol boats along the coast to prevent anybody from infiltrating. But again, understanding what the gaps are, and then, right, in this case, right, it's better local police, relations with the community. So if they see an outsider coming in, they're more likely to report it. In the military, you always have these same kind of gaps, and it's figuring out what you can leverage and how can you minimize this gap.
Absolutely. And that was a part of our planner's course as well. Why I mentioned, I think it was General Townsend who said that about, you know, the biggest urban battle since World War II, Mosul, about those flows that are so critical to continue to incorporate it into analysis, whether it's intelligence analysis or mission analysis or whatever, these flows in cities. And this attack highlighted how they could be used against the city itself, every aspect of it. Okay, the next tactical lesson was, which is I think is fascinating, the extent which technology enabled the attackers to maintain real-time coordination with the handlers and adapt to the unfolding fight. We talked about kind of throughout this talk how they did that, but it's a huge lesson, and it can be factored into how do you reduce it, how do you account for it.
Yeah, and I'd say the last tactical lesson has to deal with gaps again, but kind of a different type of gap. And that's a danger posed by the operational seams between maritime, military, and civilian security agencies, and the need to close those gaps. And in this case, right, it wasn't so much physical. A lot of times they were at the same place physically, but their ability to communicate with one another, rapidly pass information and do that. And these are the kind of things that can be figured out in advance through training, you know, rehearsals, exercises, those kind of things. And the same thing happens in the military, right? Gaps between conventional special operations forces, partner nations, right? The same things, right? A lot of times it's not a physical gap as much as really a command and control gap.
Absolutely. And I think this is, again, why this study, why this almost counterterrorism, urban policing, but national level attacks important to me is because it provides a case study of highlighting so many of these things that are almost, while specific to the details of the attack, are applicable to any city, is that there are these seams, because especially mega cities are, many of them are littoral, and they're so complex, and they have military, civilian, business, kind of the slum area, which my friend Stuart Lyle talks a lot about. This case study allows you to analyze so many different factors and really to think through application of the principles in a completely different context, whether military or policing or, you know, in between. So any parting thoughts, Liam? I think that's a great segue. Again, listeners, go and read the case study. We always put a lot of hard work into making them succinct and short enough to be used for whether it's LPD, leader professional development, or anything, just to know what happened and some of the lessons for it.
Yeah, the last thing I'd point out is, I mean, this people might sometimes view this as, nah, it's not a police thing or anything else, but no, there's a lot of similarities, overlaps, and if 10 relatively newly trained privates could kill 174 people, imagine what a trained battalion, brigade, division could do. So it's definitely a lot of lessons you can learn from this.
Yeah, 100%. And this, again, this was this is 2611. This was a national nation-changing event that rippled across the world. I think it's important that the lessons were learned, some of them learned and then addressed, which is important. So Liam, thanks a lot for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.